Welcome to Revere Asset Management's Your Money with Danny Stewart.
The market will always overshoot to the downside and to the upside.
And Don Vandenborg.
Because it's not how much you make in the markets, it's how much of that you can keep.
Did the markets just change character? Should you? Should you make changes in your portfolio? Well, not according to Jeremy Siegel. He said there is more room for this bull market to run, and he is bullish. Well, I'm glad he's so confident, and I wish I could enjoy his enthusiastic confidence, or I guess irrational exuberance would be another way to say it. But I'm okay being long because I have a sell discipline. So we're going to go over this with a big overlapping theme today. And frankly, Revere's beliefs and our system is kind of what the show's about today, because the markets have changed or may be changing. Maybe they haven't. Maybe this is just a pause. But we're going to look at that, and we're going to go over the mailbag. And normally I do a big dialogue and stuff today, but today it's going to be more market focused. But I do want to touch on gold. Is gold a warning sign? Or is it just running with the markets? And there's an article on that. Also, the DOL fiduciary rule is finally being finalized. I'll let you read that. That's in the show notes. But the bottom line is it's being ramrodded through so that you can be protected from you and get that lifetime income from annuity companies and get a big basket of mutual funds from the biggest lobbyist on Wall Street. So congratulations. We got a new, well, looks like it's going to be finalized. And also the COLA estimates are out. Well, the estimates are still, so far they got bumped up a little bit. They're at 3% for 2025. And active versus passive, active funds for the first quarter of this year are beating the indices. It was opposite last year. Last year, indexing worked quite well, but this year it is all about active management. And the 10 best largest funds, a lot of them are the American funds. Some of them are dodging. One of them's Dodge and Cox. One of them, the Fidelity Contra Fund, J.P. Morgan Large Cap Growth. What is the overlying theme with all of these funds? They all own the big Mag 7, the big tech stocks that are doing so well and helping support this market. The question I have is, what happens when that turns around? Good question. All right. Very quickly, I want to go to the mailbag first, and then we're going to go over this article. And then I think we're going to go straight into the notes now, to the market, excuse me. So this is a mailbag. This is 411 from Anonymous. He asked me not to use his name because it's some personal stuff. He wanted to cover some future planning in regards to Roth conversions. Prior to turning 72 in 2029, based on my 2023 tax return, I was $16,000 under the 22% bracket. And this guy's retired. He's a client. Future years, approximately the same. Would you recommend Roth conversion? Also, should I do qualified charitable distributions, QCDs, at 70 and a half? He wasn't sure whether he had to wait till he had to do his RMDs or can do them at 70 and a half. And I said, so basically he's saying, rather than taking bigger RMDs in the future, should he take some out now and convert to his Roth while he's still at a low tax bracket? He said, I expect my charitable to remain the same or possible. Doing QEDs will shield some from taxes. Yes, that's correct. It will. And I said, you're thinking is spot on regarding the conversion. Take out as much as you can at the same tax bracket at 12% until you hit 22%, then stop. As far as a charitable giving, that is a wonderful way not to pay taxes as long as you're going to do it anyway. All right. This is from ND on X, formerly known as Twitter. And this is from Santiago Capital. She's forwarded me a tweet and asked me to explain. So Santiago Capital, their tweet says, let's try to explain this in a different way. Reason the USD, the dollar, will be the last fiat standing, meaning currency, fiat currency, is because the rest of the world has so much US debt that can't be solved via financial repercussions from the Fed without simultaneously blowing up in local currency and vice versa. Then her comment, can you explain the second part of this to me like I'm five? I understand the dollar is strong, but I don't understand what it means about other people's local currency. This is my answer. The USD will be the last fiat currency to fall because we are the world's reserve currency and much of the world's debt is denominated in dollar-denominated bonds. Therefore, there's lots of demand for the dollar. Or, their currency is pegged to the USD. Again, more demand for the dollar. They cannot simply print their own currency causing inflation or manipulate because it is dependent on the US dollar, not their home currency. In other words, the Fed actions is what affects them, not their own central bank as much. It can, but they're really determined on the Fed. So when the Fed raises rates or keeps rates high, that makes it tough on them. Also being the world's reserve currency means you have to exchange your own home currency in USD in order to buy oil. That's the petrodollars when they talk about petrodollars. Again, strong demand. Also, most of the industrialized world has more debt to GDP than we do. Thus, other currencies are dependent upon our U.S. dollar and are in more trouble with their debt. So we got strong demand of the U.S. dollar. And even though our debt to GDP is about 130-140%, other countries are far worse. So when there is a crisis, maybe like now, everyone across the globe will still rush into the USD as a flight to quality, along with gold and possibly Bitcoin if allowed. This is as simple as I could make it. One more item for the strong USD is our military. Our nuclear subs, our F-35s, our aircraft carriers project strength and safety. Are you going to go to Sweden for safety or even the Swiss franc, even if they're strong, when everything begins to collapse? I don't think the Swiss military, especially the Swedish military, are really projecting a lot of strength. So even if the Swiss don't have a significant military to project strength, so it all comes down to perceived liquidity, safety, and demand. So with that, I'm going to quickly go into this article. Is gold warning us or running with the markets? Gold's risen by about 40% since October, is with the level of anxiety in the economy, inflation, currency, and geopolitics. So I'm going to quickly go over this. He's talking about the divorce between gold and yields. He's saying interest rates is higher, and why would gold have momentum when rates are still high? This trustworthy relationship has broken down, and this 15-year correlation between gold prices and real yields is not working. Also, monetary policy is restrictive. So it says the real rate of interest rates that has been a sturdy gauge of gold is really not working. Then he said the fiscal imbalance. The federal government has large deficits. Annual percentage increase at the federal debt is over 8%. Deficits tend lower during periods of economic growth and bigger during recessions and slowdown. But he's saying our spending is much higher and doesn't make sense if the economy is doing as well as everybody says. If we're growing, why are we having so much debt? Then lastly, geopolitical problems, Ukraine and Israel. I don't need to go into all this. So does gold predict inflation or does it? The whole point is, in summary, he said, I want to share some typical rationales justifying a higher gold, why they sound like legitimate reasons for gold to soar, taken into context. They're not much that different than other the last 20 years. Gold is more reliable and sustainable higher run when the Fed returns. He's saying he doesn't understand why gold is going higher. He thinks it's getting caught up in a speculative bubble and price is not presenting us, and price is not presenting us with the warning of fiscal, monetary, or geopolitical crisis. I humbly disagree with him on that. I think that our economy is doing well because of so much government spending, and the government budget deficits are scaring people, and also the geopolitical crisis. But my response, my thoughts, price equals truth. It doesn't matter what the reason for gold is. Personally, I think it's a fear trade right now. But whether it's the fear trade and government spending be out of control, geopolitical, from a fundamental perspective, I think it's all lining up. He doesn't. I do. But again, it doesn't matter because price is truth. And right now, gold is strong. So I set up this whole thing about, you know, just about a week or two ago, the market was acting swimmingly. The trend was up. Everything was great. Then we had two down, big down days in a row, and things looked like it's time to start getting defensive. Then you had a strong up. So we've had a couple days, both up and down, very strong. We opened up out of the gate today. It looked like it was going to be okay. And now the markets are down again. So with that, Don, I'm going to turn it over to you and ask, have we hit an inflection point? Is the market changing character, or is this more appear to be a breather or consolidation in the continued uptrend?
Well, it seems like the market's changing character every other day. but when you have stops in place for every position that you have, and you know where your downside is capped, and you've got your list of names that you're looking to buy at reasonable risk to reward entries, you can still sleep okay at night and weather the storm on all these gyrations that are happening. So let's step back to the 20th of March. This was the big breakout on the Jerome Powell FOMC, the 5174 pivot that I mentioned, where he said we were planning, rate cuts this year. Since then, though, we've got a lot of more strong economic data that cast that into doubt. And then on April 4th, we had a big break to the downside, breaking below that 5174-ish level, which had held for 2 weeks. That corresponded with a break below the 21-day moving average, which we use as our short-term trend indicator. So this big sell-off was ostensibly on increased tensions with Iran and Israel. The market rebounded the next day, sold off again. There's also been a lot of jawboning from Fed officials this week trying to talk the market down. But we held this 5140 level, which, as you can see over here, going all the way back to the middle of March, was kind of a significant support level. We bounced around it yesterday. PPI came in, well, let's go back to Wednesday. CPI came in hotter than expected, and the market gapped down, but still held this 5140 level on the S&P 500. Yesterday, PPI came in cooler than expected, and the market initially gapped up but sold off, but bounced at this, again, key 5140 level, and had a big afternoon rally to the upside, and it regained the 21-day moving average. Now this morning, the VIX is up over 20% on increased tensions, again, of a quote-unquote imminent attack from Iran on Israel. Will probably come via Lebanon, via Hezbollah. But the market pulled back strongly, but again, held at this 5140 level. So it's pretty clear where the line in the sand is for the short term on the S&P 500. As far as support goes, let's go back to the daily chart. That 5140 level is just above the 50-day moving average, which is at 5111. But if you go to a weekly chart, you can see how we're touching this 10-week moving average here, which is at 5134. So 5134 to 5140 has been the support level that we're watching, and that's the 10-week moving average. If you might say to yourself, the 10-week and the 50-day are basically supposed to be the same thing, but they're really not. And the reason for that is in a bull market, markets tend to close at the higher end of the range at the end of the week. When you calculate the 10-week moving average, you're just taking the last 10 closes, which are higher than the 50 daily closes when you do the math. And then very often you touch the 10 week before you get to the 50 day. And we focus on both numbers because it's really a zone of support, not a range of support to the penny. So as long as that 5140 level holds, we're okay with our positions. No stops have been triggered for us yet this morning. And we're just sitting and watching. Being back below the 21-day moving average has us sitting in our hands as far as new positions being added as we wait to see what our current positions have and whether their stops get hit or whether they bounce at that support. And what we're seeing now is a bounce at support. And as long as that continues, we'll continue holding them. But if they break, we'll take action. We've got our rules in place. We've got well over 20% gains during this rally off the lows in November, and we're just not going to give them back. We've got stops in place to protect them, and then we'll wait to see what the market decides to do. We won't get extremely defensive or bearish unless we break the 50-day moving average and the slope of the 50-day moving average rolls over, very similar to what happened back here last September, just as we were beginning the second leg down in this three legs down correction. So three trend lines that we invest over: short term, 21-day, that's the green line; medium term, 50-day, that's the red line; long term, 200-day, that's the black line. No bear market has ever happened above the black line. That's the 200-day moving average. We'll be very light on exposure if we break below the 50-day and it rolls over. We'll probably just keep a small index position unless there are things acting really well, that, similar to the way commodities have outperformed. We'll stick with those positions. But as far as individual growth stocks go, if we're below a declining 50-day moving average, they really don't have much of a chance. And we'll be locking in profits or hedging if we've got big gains for some taxable accounts for them.
So things are actually, the charts and prices are actually holding up and doing well for commodities and precious metals and even Bitcoin. Now, it doesn't matter whether that's a worry about inflation, so people are doing, you know, hard assets, or whether it's a fear trade and because of the global tensions in the Middle East and people are worried. It really doesn't matter what the real underlying reason is. It's just it's showing up in the charts, and that's how we're taking action. And if it stops working, we'll take action the other way. So anyway, I personally think it is a little bit of the chatter. The Middle East heating, it looked like the market was kind of starting to firm back up after those two down days in a row. Yesterday, it looked like it was starting to firm up, but then now it looks like the Middle East is really taking front and center stage. Don, what do the guys have?
Let's go to Connor first. We're going to have a big, he's got an update on breadth and sentiment.
Yeah, thanks, Don. So today I wanted to go over breadth, some of the primary indicators that we follow. And as always, these are secondary indicators. Price is always comes first, but nevertheless, these are good to look at. So the first chart I have, this is the NASDAQ McClellan Summation Index. And really, it hasn't trended in a while. And that goes to show the choppy action in tech sector as of recently. But so basically, this indicator has been going on a buy to sell signal on and off, no real trend. It's trading below the 10-day exponential moving average. And then the RSI is buried. And this paints a really good picture for how choppy the market has been and selective, especially for tech. Bounced off the 50-day yesterday, but overnight news hit about wars, and we're already, you know, fading that gap so far. And as you can see when you look at this, the easiest dollar periods often occur when this is trending above that 10-day moving average and it's sitting on a buy signal. And as you can see, for the past 2 months, it hasn't given any really good signals, so hard to gauge. Really just shows that there's been a lot of chop. Next one is the New York Stock Exchange McClellan Summation Index. And this is similar as well. It's been going sideways, no clear direction. The indicator is flipped on a buy and a sell signal. It seems like every other day. RSI is in the oversold and it's below the 10-day moving average. So really just watching to see if these can hook back and start trending to the upside, because as I've seen, the easiest dollar periods occur when this thing is trending. But there's been pockets of strength as well, so you can't just rely on these indicators either. And then if we go and take a look at the new highs, new lows, this has been mixed as well. This is for the NASDAQ, which has been notably weaker than the S&P 500 just due to the fact that it doesn't catch all the rotation. But the new low readings are starting to come in heavier than the new highs, and we haven't really had sustained readings in either direction. So a good tell for the strength of this rally would to see like new highs starting to stay above zero and really continue in positive readings versus going back and forth. And then New York Stock Exchange, new highs, new lows. This has been a lot better, and this is mainly to the fact that it catches a lot of the rotation. And that chart paints a whole different story. New highs have been dominating new lows for the whole time. And just this week, it came slightly below zero, new lows outpowering new highs. But overall, really nice trend, and new highs continue to dominate. And then if we look into so that's for breath. And when we look at sentiment, this is the NAM exposure index. And just the other week, we had a reading of 103.88. And oftentimes when this indicator gets over 100, you usually see a pullback in the markets. I mean, it can be delayed, but once it hit 103, we have pulled back a little bit, and this has cooled off down to 81.92 as of yesterday. So that's good to see. Some people got kicked out of the markets, and if they go higher, then I'm sure those people will chase to get back in. So good to see that cool off, good for the bull case. And then the last one is the AAII investor sentiment. As of yesterday, bulls were down to 43.3% from 47.7%. So that was about a 4% drop in bullish sentiment. And bears ticked up a little bit. The other week was 22.2%, and yesterday's reading was 24%. And then neutral readings picked up to 32.5% from 30%, which makes sense. As besides commodities, the market has been a little bit more challenging and no clear direction. So that's breath. And recently, breath hasn't been as good of an indication of trends. And that's exactly why it's a secondary indicator. Price is always going to be our first indicator, but we are always keeping an eye on these to see if they can give us any more clues into the direction of the market.
Hey, Connor, so explain to the listeners that NAM is the National Association of Advisors and Investment Managers. What does that stand for again? I can't remember.
It's for the active, and it's exposure levels for the active investment managers.
Right. So that's the quote, so the smart money. That's the smart money. And then the nationals, and then this other one is actually the retail investors.
Correct.
Right. Okay. I just wanted to clarify for people that are just joining and don't know that. A lot of people do, but some people don't.
Okay. Good stuff, Connor. Thanks very much. Now, Teddy Bull is very excited about the setup that's going on in Bitcoin. And I'm going to talk today. Take it away, Ted.
Yep. Thank you, Don. Yeah. So today in my segment, I just want to do a pretty deep dive on my thesis for Bitcoin for the next 6 to 12 months. I'm going to talk about the price action of Bitcoin, the halving, which is coming up actually 1 week from today. And that's one of the biggest events in a Bitcoin's historical price cycle, which is about 4 years long. I'm going to talk about various factors that might be causing a demand shock this year with the approval of the Bitcoin ETFs. Potentially a Hong Kong ETF by next Monday, actually. And then finally, I'm going to end with just like my analysis of what the crowd's narrative around Bitcoin is, And with these assets that don't necessarily have quote unquote fundamentals, it is really important to know the crowd's narrative, what they are trading it on. Because when there's a change in price that has a discrepancy with the narrative, that is when big red flags should be drawn. So starting off, the Bitcoin's price action speaks for itself. I've shared the volatility contraction pattern numerous times in the past on this podcast. I've given many examples like the NVIDIA setup, SMCI, the Nikkei index, and this gold 10-year cup with handle that broke out on monstrous volume and power so far. And this is what we're kind of having in this Bitcoin setup as well. Daily chart is on the left, and that presents you more of the VCP versus the weekly chart that just looks like a flag. I've highlighted the red, the orange, and the green contractions, and that's exactly what we want to see going from left to right. We want to see prices from high to low contract. And then if you look at the volume as well, it's below average within this entire base, which indicates that sellers are almost non-existent. On the weekly chart, I noted the price move up before this flag, and that's about 90%. It's just shies from O'Neill's classic high tight flag, which is 100% plus move within 8 weeks, no more than 15 to 25% correction, and then 3 to 5 week base. So we pretty much satisfied that with a 90% move up. We corrected only 12 to 13%, which just shows true power and the lack of sellers. And now we're working on our 5th week in this flag. So my expectation is, that doesn't mean it will happen, is that Bitcoin will break out within the next few days and week leading into the halving. And then, so the key drivers I'm going to talk about next, demand shock from the ETF approvals and growing fears of irresponsible physical and monetary policy around the world. And then supply shock is the halving. So let's talk about the halving first, and let's review what the Bitcoin halving is. For many people I know at Revere, like many of our clients, you guys are interested in Bitcoin. It's pretty esoteric for older generations. It's more of a millennials and Gen Z asset that people love. And so what happens on Bitcoin halving day? It happens about every 4 years. And this is determined by the number of blocks connected. And once that kind of ends, that usually corresponds to the 4-year Bitcoin halving. So on this date, the supply issuance of Bitcoin gets cut in half. And for this cycle, it gets cut in half from 900 per day to down to 450. And pretty much what that means is about 450 Bitcoin per day after next Friday will come to market. This means that miners will receive half the rewards they've received before, which I talked about in a previous podcast if you're interested. In the miners that I talked about. And this is programmed roughly every four years where the supply gets cut in half. And this is in perpetuity. And just from the supply shock itself in a vacuum, basic supply and demand, if supply drops and demand stays the same or greater, price will increase. So this is one factor in my thesis on the fundamental side for Bitcoin. And then to go to the next chart, Don, I want to talk about the demand shock that's happened this year. It started off with the Bitcoin ETF approval, January 10th, where the SEC and Gary Gensler finally approved the widely anticipated Bitcoin ETFs. The two biggest ones include IBIT, which is run by BlackRock, and FBTC, which is run by Fidelity. And what this did really was it unlocked the ability for many different types of entities and institutions to allocate Bitcoin for the first time ever in Bitcoin's 15-year history due to compliance and legal reasons. I mean, for what it's worth, we even feel more comfortable allocating a portion of our assets in the Bitcoin through IBIT versus like a BITO or GBTC, where there's premiums and discounts to NAV, whereas IBIT, FBTC essentially trade one-to-one to Bitcoin's price action. And then finally, BlackRock and Fidelity putting their names and stamp of approval on these ETFs is definitely a boost in confidence for many asset managers around the world. And then Hong Kong's approval that bottom picture, that is anticipated as well to come out sometime next week. And then the top right chart, Don, if you wanted to bring that back, that was a February's inflow, so 1 month after the ETF approval. And that's exceeded, if I can see that properly, about $4 to $5 billion in inflows, completely more than any other theme and sector ETF, even all of them combined in the month of February. And this is just the month of February, so I don't have the stats for March and the start of April either. And then finally, I just want to talk about the crowd's narrative, because it's really important just to know why people are trading Bitcoin, why they're bidding the price up, and what we might see in the future. And so the first point that people make is that Bitcoin's a hedge against the irresponsible actions of the government. We know that our government debt has exceeded $34 trillion. Our debt to GDP is over 120% at this point. And our interest expense is actually greater than our defense budget. And if looking at, seeing how commodities are trading right now and the Fed's change in tone, doesn't seem like we're going to get as many rate cuts as what the market's expected. And I was doing some research and I read a stat that if we don't see a 150 basis point, so 1.5% rate cut by the end of 2024, our interest expense will exceed that of Social Security. And that's a pretty big problem. So what the US government can do is, I mean, we can default on our debt, which will never happen. I mean, our government and our Fed will never let that happen. We can hope for this potential AI-fueled productivity boom. We have no idea how long that's going to take or how much of an impact that will be on reducing our debt, increasing productivity. Or the third option, which is probably most likely, is inflate the debt away in nominal terms. Just keep printing money, keep spending from the government to boost our economy. And then the second narrative is that Bitcoin is hard money like gold, and it is trading higher and will go higher because of inflationary pressures. And then I just want to end next week on Bitcoin Halving Day. I'll do another segment on Bitcoin, but I'll share a timeline of potential breaks in classic correlations that I have noticed and tweeted out. Actually, if you follow my Twitter, after the post ETF in the month of February, March, and this month, April. And I'll just outline a timeline of those. It's a small sample size, but just points that maybe signify that Bitcoin might be starting to trade as its own asset class and maybe even a commodity.
All right, Ted, listen.
Great stuff, Ted.
Yeah, that's a great comment. And I just got an article from a listener earlier today. I didn't have time to put it in the show notes, but I'm going to bring it up. It's going to be in the show notes next time. And we'll even talk about it a little bit. I'm just going to read you the headline. The legal system is closing in on crypto and things may only get worse. It's from the LA Times. You can go Google it and read it if you want. Personally, I've always said the biggest threat to Bitcoin is the regulators and the government, like the Fed, because, well, not the Fed's not the government, but because they don't want Bitcoin to replace their dollar, the US dollar, or other currencies. Now, I've always worried about that, but now that the regulators, the SEC, have given it their blessing, and now they've made it a legitimate investing class, and you got BlackRock and these huge, huge lobbyists that have pushed this through, I think the likelihood of that is diminishing rapidly. I think they're going to incorporate it because they do want a digital dollar so they can track you. So in any event, that's going to be interesting, Ted, to talk about that as well. I'll send that article to all you guys, and we can bring that up, kind of the regulatory as well as just your correlations. All right, thanks, Ted. Don, do you have anything?
No, I think we covered it all, Dan. We've got our levels laid out, and we'll see what the market brings us this afternoon and into next week.
Okay, I'm going to throw you an on-the-fly curveball. Folks, listen, at Revere here, at Your Money, we name this Your Money, not Their Money, because Wall Street thinks it's their money, but it's not. It's your money. And you can tell that we're not a beautifully polished, professionally produced show. We go out and we give you the raw data. We give you the stuff that you need to know to help you manage money. Anyway, while we were doing the show, I got a text from a client and it says, and I'm going to throw this to Don, put him on the spot. Since the dollar is in trouble because of BRICS, the BRIC countries, what do you think about investing in Japanese stocks?
The dollar's not in trouble. The dollar is a flight to quality in times of crisis. Well, I don't know why, where the dollar is in trouble came from.
They're reading that stuff on the thing. Yeah.
Okay, this is a breakout in the dollar that we've been detailing every night in our videos. We came to the top of the range last week, 2 weeks ago. Last week, we had a normal pullback into the range, and Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, we broke out of the range. It's the strongest currency in the world.
Yep, absolutely.
And there's no substitute for the dollar. That's the problem. If people say the dollar's toilet paper, the dollar's going to collapse, we're Zimbabwe. Okay, what currency is going to take its place? Well, that's one of the reasons for Bitcoin that Ted just pointed out, but governments worldwide won't let that happen with Bitcoin. People may use it as a medium of exchange, but it's not going to be the currency that runs the world. But like today, you know, we've got increased tensions in the Middle East. What happens? Money flows into the dollar. That's what happens.
And gold.
And gold, yeah.
Yeah, and so, I will say this, folks. If you really want to know how the government's going to act, remember, gold, physical gold, is really the ultimate currency because it's like Bitcoin, but it's not electronic. It's not on some computer somewhere. They can't divide it. They can't print it. It's not a fiat currency. However, during the Great Depression, they confiscated your gold. They took it from you at $35 an ounce and sold it on the international markets they confiscated it you at $17.50 an ounce, and they sold it in the open markets for $35 an ounce a few years later. So they made about a 50% return during times of deflation. So you've always heard that gold does poorly during deflation. Price is truth. The two best performing asset classes during the Great Depression, gold and silver. That's a mic drop right there. In any event, I agree with Don. There's our military, the fact that we project strength, and the fact that people need us. Now, as far as I know what he's doing, he's reading a lot of those articles talking about the BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, and China taking over, and they're trying to have their own currency or own a global currency so that they're not so dependent on the dollar. Remember when I was explaining the dollar and the Fed and why we're so strong and all these currencies, we're the world reserve currency, so everybody's got to trade in U.S. dollars. The BRIC countries don't like that. They don't like being dependent on the U.S., so they've been trying to supplant us. I get that. They should, right? Here's what you got to realize. They don't have the physical infrastructure, the electronic, the compute. They don't have the infrastructure and the trade agreements and everything already set in place to be able to do that in the next 5 years. Probably not, for sure, probably not even the next 10 years. So when people say that the BRIC countries are going to replace the dollar, it ain't happening in the next few years. It's not mechanically possible. It's just not possible. And we are not going to sit there and let that happen. I hope you understand history, but we've gone to war before in the Middle East over people trying to not over oil and the petrodollar. So anyway, folks, with that, I hope you like what you heard. Please tell a friend, tell a neighbor, and just don't go out and buy something because a couple good looking guys on the podcast told you to. Do your own research. This show is for entertainment and for education. But if you want a complimentary portfolio review or you want to reach out to us, you can email me at dan@revereasset.com, don@revereasset.com, or connor or ted@revereasset.com. And on our website at Revere Asset, up in the right-hand corner, there's a subscribe button. You can put your name in there and your email. We're not going to spam you. Reach out to us, and you'll get this show in your inbox when it's done. And you'll get Don's daily market insight videos every night the market is open. He does a quick recap and what we're looking at and moves we actually made in our portfolios. If you want it even earlier, you can go to YouTube and just go to our channel. Just search for Revere Asset. Just Revere Asset. Revere Asset. We'll talk to you next week. on Your Money.
It's not about how much you make in the markets, it's about how much of that you can keep.
Your Money Radio podcast covers general topics and investment ideas for research. It is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and is not meant to be investment advice. If you want or need investment advice, contact your own advisors or reach out to Revere Asset Management for individual investment advice. For more information, just go to revereasset.com.